The boys near him took a step away, some with that same baleful look. Only Dagon remained where he was, near Hattu's side, his gaze on the ground before him as if struggling with his choice.
"Well, what have you got to say?"
Grunter demanded. Hattu knew he was damned, no matter how he chose to answer. "I stopped at the armory in the porch. I should have been swifter. I made a mistake," he said.
"Aye! Aye, you did,"
Grunter replied, the words dripping with dark insinuation. He paced away from Hattu and strode before the recruits, then tossed up both swords and caught them overhand before driving them down into the dust.
"You have the honour of standing here today and the privilege, the mere chance, to prove yourselves worthy. The 1st Regiment of the Storm lost many soldiers last year when the Kaskans came. Veterans working the farmlands were drafted in to replace some of them. Yet still, we are one company short of 1,000. And I see 100 boys before me. Are you ready for what is to come?"
Silence.
"Are you?"
he screamed. The reply came in a thin and highly unconvincing mumble. Grunter chuckled darkly.
"You come here as lambs, weak, bleating, frightened. In the months to come, each of you will be oxen, and I will be your master. I will put your neck to the plough, and by the gods, I will drive you until your heart bursts."
His gritted teeth creaked under the strain of a gleeful rictus, and spit showered the air.
"When it is all over, we shall see who remains. Should you crumble, then you will spend the rest of your lives in ignominy. If you suffer it all as a Hittite should, then you will be lions. Your reward will be the chance to die for your country."
While Grunter spoke, Hattu couldn't help but notice the fierce and frantic drills of the other divisions. He saw from the corner of his eye 100 of the Blaze Division, gnarled and knotted as if sired by Grunter himself, each with a bird's talons painted on their hide shields.
"The pitiless ravens turn!"
the captain of that company bawled. They swung like a door, as one.
"The savage bastards! Brace!"
came another cry. This one was from 100 of the Roth Division, each with a fang emblem daubed on their hide shield. They stamped one foot in unison, then dropped into a warrior's crouch.
"Hurrah!"
they cried. "The savage bastards?" Hattu half-whispered, half-gasped, terrified and trying not to laugh at once.
"My father said they are savage," Dagon whispered in reply. "They're most certainly bastards."
"And I call you,"
a voice cut in, chokingly close, right behind and between Hattu and Dagon.
"The Herculers of Hattusa!"
Somehow, Grunter had yet again flitted round behind them unnoticed.
"Aye, that's right.
When they're not shoveling shit, they're no doubt eyeing up the sheep and the goats."
A burst of derisory laughter rang out from the veterans. The general pulled away and now strutted past in front of them. He stabbed out a finger at Hattu as he went, not looking at his target, but directing every other pair of eyes there.
"Now our pampered prince mentioned that he stopped at the armory. No doubt expected to find a jewelled spear waiting for him there and a set of plush armour."
More snorts of derision from the veterans.
"The first thing most recruits look for is a blade and a chance to play with it. But look at you. You would cut yourselves to ribbons,"
Grunter said, addressing them all. He came back to Hattu again.
"And the pampered prince, he would no doubt call for his slaves to show him which end to hold."
The veterans' laughter faded into a chorus of heckles and dark grumbling.
"In any case, what a recruit must do is not take, but give."
Grunter clapped his hands twice.
"Give his being, his body, his mind, his heart, to a life of soldiery. Our enemies call us the wretched fallen ones. They say we eat animal bones and sleep on rocks. They mock our gods and our way of life. But damn them all, they fear us like their darkest nightmares."
Grunter's face was twisted at its saurian worst now, his every word sizzling with zeal.
and I cannot allow such a reputation to slip."
From a squat red clay building by the walls, a slave boy emerged, bringing with him a hemp wrap and a stool. The lad set the stool before Korunta and unwrapped a small polished bronze mirror with an ash handle, laying it on the stool. Then he dug out a pine implement and put it there too. Hattu scrutinized the object. "A spindle," he guessed, having seen women using these when winding flax by the ambar. The lad took the last item from the wrap. It was a square of bright saffron-yellow material. He shook it, and it unfurled, revealing itself as a long woman's gown. The boy then folded it in half and laid it on the stool too. Silence. Korunta gestured towards the odd goods.
"You see here a woman's dress, do you not?"
Utter silence.
"Do you not?"
he bellowed.
"Yes,"
came a rather terrified reply.
"A mirror for applying coloured pastes to your skin. A tool for weaving pretty soft garments. Princely garments."
More laughter from the veterans, now comfortable that Hattu was here to be mocked. Korunta wagged a finger, eyeing each of the boys.
"So you make your choice. Walk from this compound and back to your homes,"
he glanced at Hattu,
"or your palaces, where you can live the soft life of a woman, or you can take the soldier's oath today."
Korunta's top lip twitched like a hidden wolf watching passing deer, seeking the weakest.
"But know that whoever takes this oath, then breaks it later, spits in the eye of the Labana and the gods, he will know no mercy."
Not a soul spoke. The only noise was the crunch, crunch of Korunta's boots as he strode to the compound gates, bashing them open with his shoulder and thigh. The general stood there in the shadow of the gatehouse and the warrior statue.
"Make your choice."
Korunta's one-eyed gaze pinned Hattu like a glowing copper rod, almost ordering him, and him alone, to leave. The cicada song grew shrill, almost deafening. Then the one-booted toothy boy, who had fainted, came too. Bewildered and still racked with terror, he rose and hobbled away from the group, across the dust, and then sprinted out through the gates, flinching as he passed Korunta.
"Anyone else?"
Korunta bawled, as the toothy boy's uneven footsteps faded to nothing. A doubting voice screamed inwardly at Hattu, almost shoving him towards the compound gates. His smoky eye ached, and he saw in the shadow of the gatehouse an ethereal form of another. That meek, round-shouldered scribe, face in shadow, just as he had seen at the postern tunnel on the day of the Kaskan raid. The imagined scribe held out a hand, as if offering to escort Hattu home. And the ethereal scholar was not alone, Hattu realized with a shiver. For up on the roof of the officer's quarters by the gate there was another. Another Hattu knew was not real. It was the strange vision of a green-cloaked warrior he had also seen at the Kaskan raid. This figure was crouched on one knee, the cloak hanging around him like a shroud, and a battle helmet obscuring most of his face. The shadows hid this one's face, but Hattu was sure he was being watched like a hawk.
"Courage comes in many forms,"
Korunta said in a low drawl.
"It takes a brave man to admit that he is not suited for certain things."
Hattu felt Korunta's words like hooks in his skin, drawing him towards the gates. But neither he nor any other moved. The vision of the scribe vanished, as did that of the watching warrior.
"Good,"
Korunta said at last, drawing the word out and pulling something akin to a smile, letting the gates close.
"Now let me take you on a journey. A journey to the edge of madness. The place where soldiers are born,"
the general said, his cruel face twisting when his gaze met Hattu's.
"And craven hearts are broken."
Chapter 8. The Edge, Spring 1302 BC. Under a hot noonday sun, the 100 boys, kilted and booted, scrambled up the steep red earth fells that rose behind the fields of bronze. Russet dust puffed into the air with every footstep, and their breaths came in gasps and croaks. Hattu felt his hurried breakfast of bread and yoghurt surge up his gullet, but each snatched breath held it back. Sweat droplets sprayed from him with every juddering step, as the scree littering the climb ensured that every stride upwards was accompanied by a slow slide back down.
"Come on! Up! Up!"
Karunta bawled, already a good 10 paces ahead of the fastest recruit.
"By the plague boar who spawns you, you'll be doing this every day, so you better get used to it."
Those in front of Hattu renewed their efforts, sending dust spraying back into his face. He closed his eyes and forged on, grasping for purchase at the hardy green shrubs that speckled the slope. This frantic scramble was nothing like the careful but continuous strain of a climb. This felt designed to make a man's heart explode. Blessedly, he reached the top of the fell before that happened. A gentle breeze touched him, not cool but a little fresher than the stifling still air down on the low ground of the compound. He sank to one knee, panting. The recruits all around him were flagging too, some dropping to the ground, others bent double and spitting, slender torsos gleaming with sweat and patches of caked dust. The portly boy, Garin, was worst off, back arching as he vomited like a cat. Only Tanku, a burly and dark-skinned lad with his long hair shaved at the sides, had reached the top a respectably short distance behind Karunta. But even he was coated in rivulets of sweat. Hattu looked all around. Up here the pastel sky seemed infinite. These fells stretched off into the western horizon, and to the south he saw the broad ancient track that stretched east and west across the Hittite domain. Behind him to the east he could see the fields of bronze down below, the compounds, paddocks and barns there, swirling in a silvery heat haze. Beyond, he could see all the way back to Hattusa, just a hulking, sun-bleached mass near the eastern skyline. And far, far away, to the north, he could even see the great soaring mountains, their snowy peaks shining like white flame in the sunlight. A dull babble of voices from other parts of the fells caught his attention. Companies of bowmen, spearmen, and slingers were dotted around the heights, marching along tight hill paths, running along high ridges, tossing rocks to one another on lofty flats, and leaping over well-worn timber and rock obstacles.
"The hot season has begun, and so the ranks come up here, where it is cooler to train," Karunta explained.
A flash of bronze on an adjacent hill betrayed a company from the Blaze Division, the 100 crouching within a bite-mark-like section of crumbled hillside. All the boys' eyes turned to the sight. The Blaze warriors had removed their leather helms, clutching them underarm so the sunlight would not catch the bronze brows. Meanwhile, an equal number from the Roth Division jogged across the hilltop above the bite mark, two abreast. Their heads were switching this way and that warily.
"Heh!"
Karunta grunted, swinging one booted foot up onto a rock and resting his palms on his hips, his good eye alight with interest as he watched. Hattu watched the hidden Blaze captain rise slowly from his haunches to steal a glance up at his prey. As the 100 of the Roth passed his men's hiding place, the Blaze captain shot up with a shout,
"For the great Sun Goddess!"
The Blaze ranks sprang from their crouches, out of the bite mark, bounding up the short stretch of slope towards the flank of the Roth men, dark hair flowing in their wake. The Roth ranks cried out, swinging their hide shields and bronze-headed spears to face the flood of men coming for them. But a discordant rattle of Blaze spearheads clattering against Roth shields brought it to an end. The Blaze soldiers whooped into light at the victory won by those mock-killing strikes. A moment later they embraced with their disappointed Roth counterparts, clasping arms and slapping backs.
"Warriors,"
Karunta said, pointing at the nearby infantry melee. Then he swung his finger across the 100 boys.
"Scum!"
He paced before them, scowling down his nose at Hattu more than any other.
"Unworthy scum!" They carry sharpened bronze. They don the garb of soldiers, because I trust them. The king trusts them. The gods trust them. You are barely fit to clamber up a gentle hillside, let alone carry a weapon. Now, every company of 100 needs a name.
He pointed at the veteran groups on the other hillsides.
The Scorpion Brotherhood, the Dark Suns, the Cruel Spears. You, I shall call you the Hill Pups.
Tanku was the only one to visibly take offence, a thick vein in the shaved sides of his scalp bulging, but he did not dare challenge the suggestion. The thick plonk of a waterskin being relieved of its cork had all heads turning towards Garin. The chubby recruit halted, the skin a finger's width from his lips, his guilty eyes looking this way and that. Korunta brought his sword round in a flash. The flat cracked against Garin's hand, and the waterskin splattered onto the ground, leaking its precious contents into the red dust.
I told you before we left, no water! Did you not understand what I meant when I told you that I am now your master? The will of your king?
Garin nodded hurriedly, gawping up at Korunta, cupping his swatted hand under his armpit. Korunta's face creased in what might have been a smile, but probably an evil one.
You know what they do up on the Acropolis when someone offends the Labana?
Garin trembled.
They treat him to a lovely meal. And a fine beverage to wash it down, Korunta purred.
Garin's face lifted in pleasant surprise. Everyone else wore looks of confusion. Apart from Hattu, who had seen the punishment once before, when a Lucan slave brought King Mersili bread and fruit water. The Lucan had a mean eye and clearly resented his role, even though it was a relatively comfortable one. That day he had made the mistake of neglecting to wash his hands before bringing the king's food, his fingernails caked with black dirt and scum. He had been seized by the Mercedi and subjected to the age-old penalty for such carelessness. Hattu's stomach churned in disgust as he recalled the stench from the plate of steaming brown fare the slave had been forced to eat, delivered straight from a palace official's bowels, and the cup of equally foul, warm, yellow liquid the fellow had washed it down with, gagging, retching, eyes bulging from his head, and tears streaming down his face as he was forced to finish every last mouthful.
Well, I have a meal brewing in here, boy. A lovely hot meal that will fill any plate,
Korunta said, patting his belly and then hitching his crotch.
And any cup.
Garin's face darkened in realization, and he dropped his head.
So, if you want water, then you must look to your prince,
Korunta said. Hattu suddenly snapped to attention, conscious of all eyes on him.
What? How?
There's enough water to slake 100 thirsty mouths down there,
Korunta said, calmly pointing back down the slope. There, barely discernible in the heat haze, two men were ferrying buckets to and from the spring of the soldier, filling them. Korunta gave them a wave, then leaned towards Hattu.
Go. Fetch, or your comrades go thirsty.
Hattu saw the pale, sweat-streaked faces, the dry, cracked lips, the baleful eyes, now hopeful, pleading. He looked downhill at the pole the two men down there were preparing like a yoke, each end laden with one full water bucket.
But I can't.
You're a prince, are you not?
Korunta gasped.
Is it not your wish to be stronger than the rest? Go, fetch. Your limbs will grow sturdier for the repetition and the extra burden.
Hattu saw the boy's gazes harden. Only Dagon offered him any encouragement, the plague-scarred lad nodding once, furtively.
Go,
Korunta snarled. Hattu backed away, then turned to the slope. The descent was swift but taxing, his quadriceps and hamstrings soon trembling with every jarring stride. He stumbled to a halt near the two soldiers.
Ready,
the pair said immediately, straining to lift the pole by its ends as if preparing to harness an ox. Hattu stammered, still catching his breath from the descent.
That's a yes,
one of the soldiers said. The pair placed the pole across Hattu's back. The two water buckets on it pressed the pole down into his shoulders fiercely, squeezing precious air from his lungs. He shot his hands up to either side to balance the pole, the water buckets at either end swaying and sloshing, a little spilling from the sides. A moment later, the soldiers tied another two full buckets to the pole, and one of them whistled gaily as he topped up the ones from which the spillage had come. Hattu staggered to adjust his footing, his arms trembling. A third pair of buckets nearly broke him. It was like carrying an awkwardly shaped, writhing, grown man.
"You better be going,"
one of the soldiers said, giving him a shove in the back. Six splashes of water escaped, and he nearly went sprawling, but he threw out a foot to stabilize himself, then another, on up the slope. The first strides were challenging and slow. The next few were utterly crushing. Everything was pulling down and back, and with his hands on the pole, he couldn't even reach down and pull on the shrubs and roots for purchase. The extra weight meant every footstep sunk nearly shin-deep into the dust and scree. He craned his neck to see up the hill and realized he was barely a quarter of the way up. Karunta stood in a wide-footed pose, hands on hips, glaring down on him. The rest of the boys stared down too, dry-mouthed, eager. Hattu heard only the rattling of his desert-dry breath and the thumping of his overworked heart. It felt as if a glowing coal rested at the bottom of each of his lungs. The sun crackled on his skin, and now every small step was an ordeal.
I can't, he croaked.
Silence. Just the staring wall of faces up at the top of the slope. He focused on them until the edges of his vision grew black. Another step, and bright colours popped and flashed. Another step, and he could see nothing. Suddenly, the weight was gone, a chaotic sensation of falling replacing it. He tumbled over and over back downhill, the red dust going up his nose and in his mouth, and more thorny roots scoring his skin. He came to a halt at the foot of the hill, coughing dust, his leg dripping blood where a root had torn it open. The pole lay just uphill from him where he had fallen, the buckets on their sides, their precious loads spilt and seeping away into the red earth. The two soldiers laughed, one tossing the other a small silver shekel bar to settle a bet.
"Try again, Prince!"
Karunta bawled down from the heights. Hattu felt a surge of nausea, and the very thought of standing, let alone climbing a hillside with a ridiculous burden, almost brought up the contents of his stomach.
"Try again, or your comrades will not drink until sundown,"
Karunta continued. Now a chorus of worried voices erupted.
"Come on, get up,"
they cried, their words edged with anger. Hattu pushed himself to his feet, his head instantly swimming.
"The pole,"
he croaked, asking the two soldiers for their help. One's eyebrows arched in surprise, and he took the shekel back from the other's palm. Hattu braced as they refilled the buckets, then loaded each one onto the pole again. He took two steps towards the base of the dusty slope, then toppled face first. A chorus of jeers rang out from the heights above, as he cast off the poles and threw up.
"No water for you today,"
Karunta concluded. The jeering intensified.
"Such a shame. Prince Muwa managed to beat the water ordeal and bring water to his comrades. I can see why they call this one Muwa's shadow."
That evening, the moment the sun dropped to touch the western horizon, Karunta gave the order for them to descend to the academy grounds. Hattu staggered downhill and over to the low, round cistern by the spring of the soldier with the rest of the recruits. The other boys fell to their knees, drinking frenetically, lashing handfuls of water across their dust-coated faces and hair. Hattu saw a space by the edge of the cistern and stepped towards it, only for Big Tanku to elbow him out of the way with a snarl. So Hattu waited until the others were done, then drank alone. He drank and drank until his gut ached from the sheer volume, then threw water over his face and hair, and slid down to rest his back on the edge of the cistern, eyes closed. He brought the lock of hair with the teardrop-shaped beryl stone round from his shoulder and toyed with it, trying to forget about the day, to block out the gruff chatter of soldiers passing here and there, and the inebriated caterwauling and clacking of cups coming from the Arzana house. He spirited himself to the high hollow with the cerulean tarn, arrow on his shoulder, a tear by his side. When he opened his eyes, he saw Karunta standing in the gateway of the infantry compound, twisting a splinter of wood in his teeth, glaring at him.
"What have I done?" he suddenly realized. "I asked for this."
As the days passed, spring turned into summer, and the unforgiving Hittite heartlands baked. Every day the hill pups were roused at dawn and fed a breakfast of goat's milk and bread with a single pot of honey to share. Shortly after, they were put through the rigours of the training field, running around a track, leaping over fences, crawling along ropes tied between two high posts, and scrambling through tight earth tunnels. Only when it came close to midday, the time when farmers, citizens, and even mangy dogs would be taking respite from the sun and sleeping in some shady refuge for an hour or two, Karunta would lead the hundred up the fells. And every single day, Hattu was tasked with descending the hill to haul water buckets to the summit in that furnace-like heat. Every single time he failed. His muscles had strengthened, as Karunta had suggested. That much was true. But he had never once reached the halfway point of the water-burdened climb before exhaustion took him. He either passed out or sunk onto one knee, knowing there was nothing left in him. He had tried to carry one bucket to the top at a time. Karunta had let him reach the top with the first, before snatching it and pouring it out.
"One ascent, 6 buckets,
the general had growled gleefully. One day, exactly a moon after he had arrived at the academy, Hattu descended the hill at Karunta's order and came to the two smiling soldiers and the water pole. He eyed the sight as if he had just tasted sour beer, but said nothing. Today, he would broach the halfway point, he affirmed. It was a crumb of focus, something to stave off the madness of it all. The hill could not be bested with such a burden, surely. Yoked with the water poles, he began to climb. Up, up, dust, rasping breath, skin on fire, muscles burning. He even found himself taking a few steps beyond the halfway point. But then came the thud of his knees into the dust, and the chorus of exasperated jeers from above. He squinted uphill, seeing Karunta up there, smirking. The dog had set him an impossible task, and he knew it.
"Now let me take you to the edge of madness, the place where soldiers are born, and craven hearts are broken."
Hattu felt a fresh wave of vigour. With a groan, he forced himself to his feet again. Karunta's smirk faded, and the boys up there cried in hope. He took 1, 2, 3 steps. Then blackness fell like an executioner's blade. One of the soldiers from below climbed up to rouse him, pouring a bucket on his face and slapping him. Hattu sat up and gratefully gulped the remaining water.
"Thank you," he said.
"I won't be thanking me,"
the soldier said coldly, his eyes flicking to the hilltop. Hattu stood shakily, seeing the wall of faces up there, twisted in anger, enviously eyeing the water dripping from Hattu's chin.
"You better get up there,"
the soldier said, dragging the pole and buckets behind him back downhill. Hattu hiked up the rest of the slope, his brain throbbing and his limbs trembling. When he reached the summit, Karunta snorted and turned away from him.
"No water. Again."
"Sir, let them drink," Hattu rasped.
Karunta swung back and shrugged.
"Why? So you feel better about letting everyone down? I don't think so."
"Sir, please," he insisted.
"Half rations tonight for all of you,"
Karunta barked matter-of-factly.
"You can thank your prince for that in a moment."
Hattu felt his blood run cold.
No,
he mouthed, as he saw the faces of the other recruits fall, then twist into cruel glares, all fixed upon him. Karunta broke the wicked spell by putting two fingers between his lips to issue a shrill whistle. A trio of storm soldiers brought over a bunch of spear poles, devoid of bronze tips, and a stack of shields.
Now, split into two teams of 50 and face each other in a line. It's time to see how easily you buttercups bruise,
Karunta purred, slitting the string, holding the poles together, and tossing them one by one to the boys. Hattu caught one spear pole. It was heavier than he had expected, and rough to the touch, enough so that it did not slip in his grasp. He slipped into place on one line of 50. Dagon was by his left side, and Garin on the right. He eyed the boy directly across from him in the opposing line of 50. A little shorter than him, but definitely sturdier, too. An even match.
With the infantry, it's all about holding shape. There's two men working together in a forest melee. There's a company of 100 standing in square, anchoring a chariot manoeuvre, or as part of an entire division, standing together in a line across a desert plain. You must stay on your feet and work together as a unit. Sometimes it is fitting to charge, to sprint. Other times you must measure your foe and approach carefully, slowly, retaining an ability to defend yourself as well as strike at him. Spear and shield epitomize this balance perfectly. Take a shield. See for yourselves.
The trio of storm soldiers began handing out the shields. One, covered in tanned, dark brown cowhide, was thrust into Hattu's hands. It felt solid, but lighter than he had expected. It covered him neck to thigh, with the sides curving inwards like a lady's waist. For a moment, he became lost in a brief and inappropriate reverie of a tear.
Now rest your spear against the right side of your shield. Like so, Karunta said,
showing them the correct grip and battle stance. Left leg forward, right foot anchoring, spear held in the right hand and the shaft resting against the waist of the shield. Hattu followed suit, lifting his shield a little to place the spear there. Almost by accident, the edge of Dagon and Garin's shields clacked against his own, with their spears poking from the almond-shaped gaps between the touching edges. It was the same all along the line.
See? Like the scales of a lizard and the quills of a porcupine,
Karunta chuckled in satisfaction.
Now, your task is simple,
he said, drawing a line in the dirt with the end of his boot behind each team.
Drive the other side back. Capture the hilltop as your own. As soon as any one member of either side falls back over their line, the game is over. It is a test of strength and a lesson that any group of soldiers is only as strong as their weakest link. Don't let it be you, Karunta said.
The general then stroked his chin.
First, though, let's mix things up a little. You move here. You there,
he said, as he rearranged the opposite team, drawing the short, stocky recruit away to another spot in the line. Hattu soon understood Karunta's game. Now it was Tanku, the burliest of all the recruits directly across from him. The boy's lips, blistered and scabbed from the tortuous denial of water, lifted like an angered mastiff's.
What are you waiting for?
Karunta bawled.
Charge!
With a clamour of shouts and panicked shrieks, the two opposing walls of recruits surged together. Hattu swung up his spear pole as he and Tanku bounded for one another. Crack! Their shields and spear shafts met, and Tanku's face was a finger's width from his own, teeth clenched. After that instant of collision, the pair fell back. Whack! They clashed again. This time Tanku's brute strength won out, driving Hattu back towards the line. Hattu saw he was but paces from falling over it.
You're finished here, Tanku growled. Cursed son!
Hattu knew he only had one option. In a trice, he released the tension on his shield and spear pole and swung away from Tanku like an opening door. Tanku's incredible momentum sent him flailing forward, across the dirt line and onto his face. The struggle amongst the other boys ebbed as they saw what had happened. Confusion reigned.
Have we won? Garin asked.
No, Tanku fell over their line,
another insisted. Hattu was caught between offering Tanku a hand to get to his feet and seeing what Kurunta had to say about it all, when Tanku rose and hooked a ham-like fist across his face. A shower of white light shot across Hattu's eyes, and he spun wildly away, crashing into the rest of the boys.
"You witch!"
Tanku cried, the veins on his shaved temples pulsing like angry worms.
"I've had enough of you! You don't belong here! For an entire moon I've been starved of water from morning till sunset because of you! Tonight I will eat a pitifully small meal because of you! No more! No more!"
He screamed, then leapt at Hattu. Hattu braced. Dagon leapt between them, only for someone else to punch Dagon. A moment later, and two boys, Sargis, a beanpole of a lad, a good head taller than Tanku, and Kisna, a hawk-faced recruit with jaw-length hair, pounced on Dagon's attacker. In a few breaths, the two groups of 50 had dissolved into a sprawling mass of flailing arms and legs, young men thrashing on the ground, yelping as others collapsed on top of them. Some had dropped their spear poles and taken to using fists and feet. One had pinned another to the ground and was vigorously punching him in the crotch over and over, the pinned one's wails growing steadily more piercing. Hattu saw the livid face of Tanku, stranded, like him, on the opposite side of the melee.
"Oh, dear sweet Lord of the Storm!"
Kurunta boomed, striding around the ruckus, hands clasped behind his back.
"This is surely the sorrowest shower of dogs I have ever been burdened with. Enough! Enough!"
The fighting pack broke apart, the recruits panting, spitting blood, moaning, warily cupping wounds, the boy with the pulverized crotch wearing a haunted look. Kurunta weaved between the 250s in a figure of eight.
"If I took you into battle today, I would be digging 100 graves tonight. Training is over for today."
With that, the gnarled general turned and strode away, his silver tail jostling as he made his way down the red earth slope, back towards the academy far below. That night, Hattu sat on the dormitory porch alone. A hearty aroma of spiced carrot stew wafted from inside the sleeping quarters. He looked over his shoulder. The porch armory was now stocked with the poles and shields they had been given that day. A burst of laughter erupted from inside. He saw the boys there in the orange glow of tallow light, eating their half rations, drinking and bantering. Garin telling them some tale about his pet cats and their antics back home in Hattusa. They were exhausted but undeterred. He, it seemed, was as hated as Kurunta. When he noticed a veteran from the neighbouring dormitory walking nearby, carrying a basket of bread, his belly growled fiercely. And an idea sparked in his mind. Perhaps there is one last chance to make things right, he wondered. He tugged his hair round to hide his smoke-grey eye, then jumped to his feet and ran over to the soldier.
"Can you spare me a few loaves?" he asked.
The soldier looked him up and down, then shrugged.
"In exchange for what?"
Hattu patted at the hair hanging by his ear, then drew one lock around and pulled from it the only thing of value on his person.
"This stone is beryl,"
he said, untying it and offering it reluctantly. The soldier eyed it, then took it, not quite believing his luck, handing Hattu three rounds of bread.
"Thank you,"
Hattu said. His hair slipped back from his smoke-grey eye as he said this, and the affable soldier's face drained of humour.
"You?"
the man said, then hurried away.
"Aye, me,"
Hattu whispered in reply to the space the man had been occupying. Hattu took the three loaves back into his own dorm. The chatter amongst the boys fell away as they saw him.
I brought you these, to make up for the ration cut.
Silence. Sargis and Kisna, the two who had helped Dagon during the brawl earlier that day, licked their lips, eyes fixed on the fresh loaves. Garin's belly growled in an unfortunately timed protest. Every other recruit in there followed Tanku's lead, glowering at Hattu. It was only when Dagon stepped forward as if to accept the loaves that another boy cut in, stepping out before Dagon, facing Hattu.
"Well, the son of the king spoils us tonight,"
the boy sneered, snatching the bread from Hattu's arms.
"Three whole loaves! We are truly grateful!"
Hattu gulped. Dagon had slunk away into the shadows. The hard stares of the others remained. He backed away and left them to it, returning to the porch. He slumped to sit once more and gazed up at the sky, sprinkled with a silvery sand of stars. If a man travels far enough, the stars themselves will change, old Ruber had taught him. He made out the great hunter, the constellation in the shape of a man drawing a bow.
Aye, old tutor, that may be. But as things are, I will likely never find out, he mused,
looking eastwards in the direction of Hattusa, thinking of the scribal school.
Why am I here?
He sighed, looking over at the small lodge by the compound gates where Kurunta slept, his snoring almost shaking the building. He noticed that the compound gates were open. Odd, he thought. Usually they were closed and barred. Realization dawned. There really was nothing stopping him from leaving. And there, in the shadow of the gatehouse, he saw the vapor-thin mirage of the round-shouldered scribe staring at him, beckoning him. A bout of laughter sounded from inside, and the last crumbs of conviction fell away at that moment. He began to rise from where he sat.
Perhaps it is time to go home, he said sadly.
Who are you talking to?
A voice replied. Hattu started, then looked round to see Dagon emerging from the dorm.
Myself, Hattu said, I think.
I bought you this,
Dagon said, handing Hattu a steaming bowl of carrot stew.
I can't, Hattu waved a hand. It's my fault the ration was halved.
Dagon chuckled.
Hulky's balls it was. That was Karunta's doing.
Not in their eyes it wasn't,
Hattu muttered, flicking his head towards the dorm. Dagon looked inside with a sigh, then sat down and gestured for Hattu to do likewise. Hattu lifted one side of his mouth in a pathetic attempt at a smile as he sat.
Be wary of sitting next to the cursed sun, he said.
Dagon laughed nervously.
I know how it feels, he said, to have every smiling face turn sour when it looks upon you.
Hattu saw how he traced a fingertip over the deepest scar pits on his face as he said this.
When I was 9 summers, my mother never tired of telling me how handsome I would be when I became a man. That autumn I fell ill with the plague. I survived, as you can see, but life is different now. Some people avoid me as if I still carry the pox. Mother isn't quite so effusive about my looks anymore.
Hattu sensed the boy's awkwardness, but felt a great warmth inside at this. The first civil conversation he'd enjoyed in a month.
I was certainly pleased to see you that first day I arrived. When I was arse deep in Orstung,
he said, brightening up.
Then it seemed like torture.
Now,
Hattu finished for him, shooting a sour eye at the shadowy outline of the red fells,
I'd pay to shovel dung all day long.
He picked up the bowl and took a spoonful of carrot stew. It was thin, but salty, warm and flavoursome, and instantly gave him a sense of well-being.
Thank you, he said.
Dagon said nothing. Hattu ate in silence for a while before the boy spoke again.
Do you remember the first day I saw you?
No,
Hattu lied.
It was at the Tawinian Gate, on the day of the gathering. You and Prince Moatali were entering the city. I remember scowling at you then. I did it because others did. I'd heard the things they said about you, that the dark earth stalked you and those close to you. I thought it was the right thing to do. Since then, I've learned to think for myself.
He jabbed a thumb over his shoulder.
To the pits with that lot.
To the pits,
Hattu smiled. Dagon returned inside, and Hattu remained where he was to the rest of his meal. A while later, the dormitories were silent, the tallow lamps within extinguished. A hunter's moon cast a pale light across the still night, and Hattu remained by the porch. Once more, he saw the meek scribe in the compound gateway. Rising, he stretched and walked towards the vision. The scribe vanished as he approached. Outside the compound, the grounds of the academy were devoid of movement. Crickets croaked, and a drunk soldier lay slumped by the door of the Arzana house. Looking east, he saw the few sentries posted near the academy's perimeter, standing around braziers. Now the ethereal scribe was there, one finger coiling and uncoiling, summoning him further east. Hattusa was only a few hours' walk away. Safety, peace, sanctuary from this ritual humiliation. Would they stop me? He mused aloud, looking at the sentries. If I simply left now? The idea seemed sweet, soft, and seductive. He found himself walking towards the perimeter. By morning, he could be visiting Atia. He could groom Arrow in the comfort of the Acropolis halls. He took another few steps closer to the sentries. What would Father think? What would the people say about him now? The cursed son? Or the craven son? To the pits with them, he said, the words coming from deep within. It was only now he realized he had stopped in his tracks. And to the pits with you, he repeated at the ethereal scribe. He turned away from the academy perimeter, swinging back to face the red fells instead, eyeing them moodily. I can do this, he whispered. He took a deep breath, then set off at a run towards them, ploughing up the lower slopes undaunted, his eyes on the top. Atop the hills, he fell to his knees, panting in a sliver of moonlight. It was not the climb that was the challenge, he realized, but the heat of day and the burden of the water. How can a man better the divine sun than the weight of the sacred water? He gasped into the night. Silence. His eyes fell to the flat, boot-marked fell tops before him. The moonlight betrayed a lone ant scuttling across the dust, bringing with it a tiny chunk of earth and placing it down by a red boulder. The first part of a new nest, he realized. Poor creature, he said, guessing that the ant was separated from its swarm. Alone, it could never build an entire nest. An impossible feat. I have more in common with you than my soldier kin, it seems. Chapter 9. The Mountain Wolves. High Summer 1302 BC. Summer grew hotter by the day. One sultry evening, the officers met in the command building by the paddocks. Once their planning talks were over, a few remained, drinking and chatting. General Nuanza eyed his colleagues, the unanswered question floating between them like bad wind.
Volker, he is a shrewd one, Coulter answered first, smoothing at his forked beard.
Shrewd? Kurunta scoffed. He's a bumptious fool with a voice like a chisel.
Nuanza roared with laughter.
And then I am lucky to have spent little time with him.
Kurunta gulped at a cup of wine and slammed it back down on the table, the sound echoing and drawing surprised looks from the few other officers in there. Kurunta shot them all a sour eye, then turned back to Nuanza.
Who taught him to speak our tongue? Ruba, was it? The old goose wants stringing up for that, for Volker never shuts up now. On and on, riding over my every attempt at a sentence and echoing my ideas to the king with a boldness that seems to cover up the fact they were my bloody ideas in the first place. But even his apologies, rare as they are, seem offensive. And that helmet. Who wears a ridiculous helmet with bull's horns like that all the time? An arsehole in the king's retinue. Who'd have thought it?
Nuanza chuckled again.
He's not Hittite, not even from the vassal lands, Kurunta moaned.
Nor was I,
Coulter said with a raised eyebrow, now tugging testily at his beard.
When I came here, I was a mere Hurrian beggar. The king could have cast me aside, but he did not.
Kurunta's shoulders slunk, and he sighed.
Well, I meant no offence, old horse.
The worst thing you can do is let his behaviour get under your skin,
Nuanza suggested.
Find a way to tolerate him.
Kurunta shook his head, spreading his fingers on the surface of the table and rolling his shoulders.
But he's everywhere.
When he's not at the king's side, he's lurking around the palace like a ghost.
True, Coulter mused.
Always seems to be in and out of the scullery.
The cellar kitchens,
Nuanza said, his V-shaped brow drawing together.
If he's caught down there with the slightest speck of dirt on him, then he'll be eating a plate of turds for his evening meal.
Karunta's eyebrows leapt up at the prospect.
Well, and I'd happily supply the ingredients,
he said with a happy growl.
And it seems he's impressed the king so much that he and his two cronies have been initiated into the Mercedi.
He snorted in derision.
What next?
And the two cronies are worse, Coulter reasoned. Drunkards. While Volker skulks around in the cookrooms, those two cavort with the harem girls, full of wine and acting as if they are royalty themselves.
Nuanza chortled. The two other Sherden were scrawny and pale versions of Volker. Each was uglier than the other, and they certainly were not sharp thinkers like their leader.
Braggarts, they are,
Coulter rasped, any trace of humour draining from him.
They boasted about their bravery the day they saved the king from the rampaging elephant. Belittled poor Zeda, while they were at it, crowing about how our old friend was overcome with fear at the sight of the beast. Now they had to step in.
Nuanza laughed no more.
Zeda was many things, he said in a low voice. Stubborn, miserly, foul-tempered, noble, strong as a bull and fast as a lion, but never, never was he craven.
Silence reigned for a moment. Karunta poured each of them a refill of watered wine from the mixing bowl, then drank his share in one gulp.
We'll ask Zeda what really happened when we each enter the dark earth.
He let a wry smile lift one edge of his mouth.
Perhaps there the tight-fisted swine may even see fit to buy us all a drink at last.
The three shared a bout of fond, gentle laughter. Soon after, Coulter stood to depart, and Karunta followed, leaving Nuanza alone. As the humour died, he felt a niggling sense of untidiness in his thoughts. Something about the conversation just shared seemed askew. He stroked his bottom lip and searched his recent memories, until, like a key sliding into a well-oiled lock, he remembered. King Masili had told him of the elephant hunt after returning to the main army column.
Zeda is lost, the king had said.
He charged into the path of the elephant, knowing it would crush him, but knowing also it would buy me a trice within which I might save myself.
Whatever the Sherden drunks were telling the Acropolis harlots was a lie. Zeda had not been frozen with fear. And then another memory rose to the surface. It was of the time he and Zeda had been on a patrol to the city of Arena. On the way there, they had come across a bull elephant stricken with sickness, agitated and trumpeting near the edge of a stream to which the approach was rocky and steep. The elephant was trying to step down the uneven surface, but for some reason kept pulling back. Zeda had approached slowly, obliquely, not getting too close, then slid down to the stream to fill a leather bucket with water and bring it back up, placing it near the elephant. Now the creature moved closer, plunging its trunk into the bucket and drinking it dry. A few bucketfuls later, and the creature was calm. Zeda stroked its trunk, then sank to his knees to draw from its foot the long thorn that had prevented it from negotiating the rocky slope to the stream. Many men were overcome with fear on sighting elephants, and rightly so. Zeda was not one of them. Karunta's earlier rant came back to him now.
It seems he's impressed the king so much that he and his two cronies have been initiated into the Mercedi. What next?
The words took root in the master archer's mind. His high forehead furrowed, and his pensive eyes stared long and hard into his wine. Another month passed, and Hattu ran up the Red Hills most nights. Someone was leaving the compound gates unlocked, and Hattu found it difficult to resist the call of the night. He took to carrying rocks in his hands to make the scramble tougher at first, then small bags of rocks, then sacks slung over his shoulders. And once up there, he sought out stretches of scarp and bluff to climb and clamber over,
still with the rocks on his back.
Your limbs will grow sturdier for the repetition and the extra burden.
Aye, but down they will,
he panted, flopping onto the hilltop, barefoot and sweating. His body was like knotted rope in places where muscles had developed. He flexed his shoulders, encouraged by their newfound breadth. He was still lean, but by the gods he was getting stronger. Calluses lined his feet and his palms, and his mind too, he was sure. But the challenge of carrying a sack of rocks was not as great as the burden of 6 full water buckets, not even close. Still, the daily humiliation continued. Today, Tanku had come close to losing his cool again, and the truth was, Hattu wouldn't have blamed him for it. There had to be an answer, a way of stuffing Kurunta One Eye's ridiculous water ordeal down his throat. There had to be. The faintest scratching noise caught his attention. His eyes searched the moonlit dust until he pinpointed it. He laughed once in surprise when he saw there a slim, waist-high mound of earth. The ant's nest was taking shape. The scratching sounded again, and the lone ant scurried over with a piece of red earth on its back, climbed the mound and placed its cargo on the tip. Back and forth the ant went, constructing the final parts of its nest. Hattu watched, enchanted, for some time. He approached the nest, beholding it as if it might share its secrets with him. As he drew closer to it, he knelt, tracing a finger through the shallow furrow from which the ant had been lifting earth. The palest sensation on his fingertips triggered a sudden realization. He looked down, lifting a little between fingers and thumb, rubbing it, the granules falling away. At once, he was in Ruba's classroom again, trying to make sense of the old man's chalky etchings on a slate.
The sacred earth itself is alive, veined with life.
The moonlight caught his eyes as they flicked at the edge of the hill in the academy below. He saw the eternal dung heap, studded with a few spades. Then he saw the ring of stone that marked the soldier's spring. Finally, he looked back to the shallow furrow of earth upon which he knelt. A broad smile crept across his face. The moon waned, vanished, and waxed once more. Another month where every night Hattu ran to the red heights. Nobody saw what he was doing up there, but some heard faint scraping noises over and over. And every day under the boiling sun, the recruits ran up the hillside. They trained hard, then watched Hattu struggle and fail in Kurunta's water ordeal. One day, Hattu and the 100 hill pups spilled from the dormitory at the first wail of the dawn call. They snatched up their poles and shields and fell into place on the muster area in moments, even before some of the veterans had done so. And now they were all well drilled enough to have dressed in time, each in linen kilt and leather boots. A few of the recruits shared triumphant looks. Hattu, however, felt the ache in his back and shoulders from his night endeavours, and his mind was foggy from little sleep. He glanced down, seeing his fingernails were still packed with red earth.
Stay strong, he told himself.
Kurunta stomped before them with a face like a dark nightmare, as if angered by their improvement.
Dog ugly curs, he muttered under his breath.
Hattu wondered if the general even realized he emitted such thoughts aloud.
3 months of my life I've had to put up with you. 3 months of my life I'll never get back, he added.
Then reluctantly raised a hand and clicked his fingers. An ox wagon emerged from the gated armory building near the compound's southern walls, its wheels grinding on the dusty ground as it made its way over to the recruits. Hattu saw upon it heaps of dark, polished leather, bronze studs, and off-white cloth.
Now that I've dragged you bastards this far, I'm obliged to see how you fare with weapons in your hands.
He and a pair of storm soldiers unbolted the back end of the wagon and lifted out a bundle of swords, hilts bound in leather, bronze blades curved like Kurunta's twin swords, but not as long, and tall honed spears.
Real weapons. And because I just know one of you will stab yourself, I must also provide you with armor.
Hattu felt his mouth dry out as the general thrust a pair of weapons into his hands. his face uplit by the luster of a leaf-shaped bronze spearhead. Grunter hesitated for a moment, not letting go of the arms, emitting a low, grumbling sigh.
"You can trust me, sir," he said.
"When you bring water to the hilltop for your comrades, then I will trust you," he scoffed, then stepped away.
Hattu watched him go, eyes narrowed.
"First time you've held a sword?"
Dagon asked, examining his blade. "Aye," Hattu said, gazing at the leather pommel and the blade's keen edge. It was light but solid in his hand. He slid the blade through his belt by his left hip so it hung to his thigh. Another storm soldier shoved a white linen tunic and a dark leather cuirass into his arms. Dagon had been given a padded linen vest instead, a single lighter layer and more supple, providing just as much protection. Hattu pulled on the tunic, then the pair helped one another slide the armored corselets on over each other's heads, securing them by tying the buckles at the sides. Hattu's leather vest was stiff, uncomfortable, and too big for him, and it bit at his collarbone. An instant later, he was deafened by a scraping noise, as something was thrust upon his head. A toughened leather helmet with a bronze brow band, the leather cheek guards and avantail settling around his face and the nape of his neck. He could smell the old leather and the sweat of men who had worn it before him, and a trace of a sickeningly familiar, evil, coppery stench.
Blood?
He suddenly wondered if it had been taken from a fallen soldier. Indeed, he noticed Dagon's helmet bore a dark stain and a score that had nearly torn through the leather. The soldiers then handed out savage, fanged maces and small, glinting bronze axes to each man. Hattu received an axe and eyed it for a moment. The curved head had two large circular holes, a means of sparing every scrap of precious bronze, and the back edge had three jutting